And our guest, Charles Richbloom, his latest book, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. This hour, as we continue chatting with him, we'll take your calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final hour with Charles Richbloom, the author of The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. Charles, we all remember the tragedy of 9/11/2001 when two jets smashed into the World Trade Center towers. But a lot of people don't realize that in 1945, the Empire State Building got hit.
Right. That's forgotten now, but, you know, people, when that was originally built, the Empire State Building in the early 1930s, people were wondering, you know, what if a plane ever crashed into that? What would happen, you know, because it was so high? It was the highest building in the world for many years. But anyhow, it did happen in 1945. There was an Army plane that got lost in the fog on a Saturday morning.
A B-25.
Right, in New York, and it crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building and started a fire which raged in about four floors of the building. But the amazing thing is, now here's a plane that crashed right into the building. In fact, the plane went, you know, through a window and through the bricks and right into the building itself. Very fortunately, it was a Saturday, so most of the offices were closed, or many of them were closed.
Mm-hmm.
There were 14 fatalities. The three guys on the plane were all killed, and there were 11 other people in the building who basically were killed by the fire more than the collision with the plane. And the plane dropped down to the ground, and fortunately nobody on the ground was hurt, which was kind of amazing. But the most amazing thing about the story, George, is that was a Saturday morning. The building opened for business as usual the following Monday morning.
Oh, my God.
How's that?
How?
Those four floors were closed where the fire was and where the real damage was.
They contained them.
Yeah, but everything above that and below that was untouched, and the building was so well built. And by the way, it was built in less time than they thought. It cost less than the original estimate. There were so many great things about that building. It was, you know, constructed in the early Depression days where the guys working were so happy to have a job. They worked many hours and did such a good job. But anyhow, the building survived and it was business as usual the next Monday morning, except for those four floors, which eventually were taken care of.
Couple more questions, and we'll go to phone calls. You talk about football. You have a real funny story about how important football is.
Yeah, this is a classic story that we decided to put in the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. There's a big football game, capacity crowd, the biggest game of the year. And the guy's sitting on the 50-yard line, and the seat beside him is empty. And let's call this guy Mike.
Okay, that's a true story.
Mike is sitting there, right, and the seat next to him is empty. The row behind him, there's a guy named John sitting right behind him, and John notices, and tickets were real hard to get. You know, it was a capacity crowd, big game. And this guy named John behind Mike sees the empty seat there, and after a few minutes, he taps Mike on the shoulder and says, is that your seat that's empty? And Mike says, yeah, that was my seat. My wife and I came to every game for many years. We never missed a game. And unfortunately, she has passed away.
Oh, jeez.
So the guy sitting behind him, John, says, oh, gee, I'm sorry to hear that. But he said, well, why didn't you give that ticket to, you know, somebody else, maybe a friend, a relative, a neighbor?
Or me,
yeah,
he's probably thinking.
And Mike says, well, no, he said, I couldn't do that. They're all at the funeral.
Oh, he wasn't at his wife's funeral?
Well, whether the story is true or
oh,
not.
Oh, my know, God.
But it's an apocryphal story about how important football is. Can be.
What was the game called, the Confusion Bowl?
Yeah, there were actually two games, once called the Confusion Bowl for very good reason. There are two colleges in America that play major college football whose name is Miami. There's Miami of Florida, of course, and Miami of Ohio, which also plays major college football. And for 2 years in the 1940s, Miami played Miami. And sports writers called those games the Confusion Bowl. And then, as we say in our book, and by the way, Miami won both games. That is, the University of Miami of Florida won both games.
Here's one of your greatest mathematical questions about multiplying any number by 9. What's the result?
It's incredible.
It's always 9 add it across.
Exactly. Take any – let's just give a couple examples here. Let's start easy. 9 times 2 is 18. You take the answer, 8 plus 1 is 9. 9 times 3 is 27. 2 plus 7 is 9. 9 times 4 is 36. 3 times 6 is 9, and so on. But you can do that no matter what
any number.
Any number. Let's take a little bigger
103 times 9. 927.
Okay.
Add them across, you get 18. 1 plus 8
is 9.
It's 9. That's amazing.
9 times 35, for example, is 315. So you take 3 plus 1 plus 5, that's 3 and 1 is 4, and 5 is 9. Let's take one bigger one we have in the book. 9 times 4,000. Let me see if I can find it here. 4,600. Wait a minute.
Any number.
Well, let's just take this one here, I guess. 463. And the answer is 4. Yeah, that's it. 9 times 463. The answer is 4,167. So 4 plus 1 is 5 plus 6 is 11 plus 7 is 18, and there you go.
That's 9 again. I love it.
Yeah, any number at all. You can take any number at all, big or small, and it always adds up to 9.
To the phones we now go, Ed in Tehachapi, California. Edward, go ahead.
Hey, George, this is a perfect night. I think the planets lined up tonight with I have a story to tell, a historical true story.
Okay.
I've been waiting to tell till the right time, and with you being a singer, and Charles being from Pittsburgh, my hometown, and a longtime KDK person.
I love it.
And in fact, before I give that as a tease, because before that I wanted to say my family came from Germany in the mid-1800s, and I can verify Charles's history about the Christmas tree, because that's what my old relatives
sure.
used to talk about all the time.
That's great.
So anyway, here's the story. So, and this is in Pittsburgh, and so that's why I think the planets lined up tonight with Charles and what he does, and the fact that how Coast to Coast tells so many interesting things. So we have to go back to the early 1900s, maybe 1920 or so. I had an uncle. Actually, he was my great uncle. But he was so much younger than his brothers that he was more the age of my dad. So we, the younger generation, we kids called him Uncle Ernest, even though to us he was great uncle. And back in those days, he was head of the Barbers Union in Pittsburgh. And he had the number one barber chair in what I don't remember anymore, the fanciest hotel in Pittsburgh. I never saw him in all the years I knew him. I never saw him not dressed in a three-piece suit.
That'd be the William Penn Hotel, probably.
Yes, that's it, the William Penn. Thank you, Charles. So I knew you'd know. So there was this young guy who was in the Barbers Union, and this young guy was having a trouble deciding whether or not he was going to be a barber or he was going to be a singer. And so one day, my Uncle Ernest hauled him into the Barbers Union office, sat him down, and said, "Okay, we're going to decide today whether you are going to be a barber, in which case I'm not going to keep paying your dues, your back dues. You are going to pay up and get it over to a barber chair in town somewhere, or you're going to decide to be a singer. And in that case, I'll give you the train fare to go out to California and see if you can make it." Do you want to guess who that person was?
Well, I have a guess.
Let's see if George can get it.
Okay.
Who the individual? Did he ended up going to L.A., right?
And the other thing that's good about me telling the story now is you're hearing a lot of his Christmas music because stations like Sirius XM that have several Christmas rotation stations, you're hearing a lot of the older singers like Rosemary Clooney and Bing Crosby and the one I won't tell you.
Now we have to guess this?
You have to guess it, George.
Give me some clues.
Very relaxed person. Often was joked as he might fall asleep if you didn't put him on air quick enough.
Can I come up with the initials?
Yeah, sure.
PC? I'm not sure that's correct, but my guess would be PC.
Yep. There you go. So Charles is giving you help, George.
God, he's giving me a lot of help. PC would be a guy. Yep. Perry Como.
Yes. Got it. Perry Como.
That's funny.
So my uncle, so he decided that he would go out and try. My uncle gave him the money to go out on a train, and the rest is history.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, it was just a guess on my part. I just knew that, you know, Perry Como was, they called him the singing barber, I remember.
That's right. Well, and he was born and raised in Canonsburg.
Right, near Pittsburgh, right?
Right.
That's a great story, Eddie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, with Perry Como, they used to do skits about him on television where he would be singing, lying down like he was asleep. Because he was so mellow.
Right. Well, you know, we talked about Bing Crosby earlier, George, and he was able to sing so relaxed. He was so relaxed when he sang. You know, the words just came out like with no effort.
Dean Martin was obsessed with Bing Crosby.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
He learned a lot from him.
That's another person.
And he used to sing with Louis Armstrong. They would team up together.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a great duet in the movie called High Society.
I miss those songs these days.
Yeah.
Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Take it away, Frank.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. I feel really good this particular Christmas. Dr. Knowledge, you're one of the few people that on a long flight to Australia, I'd want to sit next to you.
not if you're trying to sleep.
You would only take a back seat to Miss Halle Berry. Anyway, one of the presidents you mentioned that was dying on the 4th of July was also born on the 4th of July. Incredible. Now, the question I want to ask you is, how did the phrase originated, the proof is in the pudding, and he was caught red-handed? Now, one researcher told me that caught red-handed was not murder by knife. It had something to do with the communist red menace in 1940s and 50s. Thank you very much. You're in my top five recurring guests on this program.
Well, thank you for that. I think that red herring started before the 1940s, but it does go back. I would think the communists back probably the World War I days.
The proof is in the pudding started with a guy named Ben Zimmer. It's in the eating. Pudding is in the eating. It meant that you had to try out the food in order to know whether it was good or not.
Very good.
It doesn't say what year. In terms of he was caught red-handed, I don't know.
Yeah. I think it goes back even farther is my guess. I really don't know for sure. I think the other question he asked was the only president born on the 4th of July. And that was Calvin Coolidge, by the way.
Interesting time. I love these tidbits, Charles. They're fun.
Yeah, and getting back, George, to the original one that we were talking about at the very beginning, three of the first five U.S. presidents all died on July 4th.
Yeah.
We almost had four of the first five because the fourth president, James Madison, died on June 28th. So he just missed July 4th by about 6 days.
Have you looked at that bizarre thing where rock stars have died at the age of 27?
Yeah. We have a story called The Curse of 27, and it's incredible how many. There's 40-some some famous people, but there's also just, you know, plain musicians are in that group too. There's 40 some musicians who died at age 27. It's called The Curse of 27.
Our first time caller, Rika in Del Mar, California. Hi, Rika.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh, sure can.
Hi, George. I really enjoyed listening to you.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to you and your guest. I was wondering if your guest in his book of Fascinating Facts has mentioned that the first day of spring is celebrated by Persians around the world, actually many different ethnic groups for over 3,000 years, and it starts from like Zoroastrians and going back to Iranian culture. So I was wondering if he has mentioned that in his book or not.
Mention anything about Persians in March 25th?
No.
Persians have been celebrating Nowruz, which is the same as vernal equinox, around the world for over 2,000 years.
2,000 years, wow.
Yes, and yeah, you can just research on that, and it's called Nowruz, which is like the first day of spring, and it's celebrated around the world every year, and actually even President Obama made it like not a holiday, but it recognized it in U.S. and it's spelled here as Nowruz, like Nowruz, and it's the first day of spring every year. So it's not March 25th, so it could be from March 19th or March 21st, whatever the vernal equinox
pops up.
There are a lot of countries before the 1700s used that old calendar with New Year's being March 25th. And as we said before, maybe it might be a good idea to change it back to March 25th, because that really is.
And the equinox now is March 21st, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. First day of spring, and spring means rebirth and growth, and that's really the start of a new year. And as we said before, when you think about it, January 1st, really, you know, not much happens on that date as compared to this.
Persian culture is very rich, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
When did the nations of the world outlaw war?
How about that? In 1928, there was a treaty called the Kellogg-Briand Treaty. It was named after the name Kellogg came. The U.S. Secretary of State was named Kellogg, no relation to the cereal people. He was our Secretary of State in 1928. And the foreign minister of France, his last name was Briand. And the two of them came up with a treaty and got most of the nations in the world to sign it. And the treaty was that there would be no more wars. The treaty outlawed wars. They prevented any nation from ever going to war again. And
I like that treaty.
Virtually every major nation in the world signed that treaty in 1928. There were celebrations. People said, hey, and this is just 10 years after the end of World War One.
I think they all forgot they signed it.
Yeah, well, you know, in 1928, people really celebrated. Yeah, there'll never be any wars again. You know, that's great.
Charles, we're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tuesday night, we begin our holiday programming for you here on Coast to Coast, our Christmas Eve program for you, and of course, our Christmas night program will be on Wednesday, and we'll have special guests, open lines, Christmas vignettes. I think you're really going to enjoy the program and really have some fun. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Charles Richbloom, author of the all-time book of Fascinating Facts. His website, Knowledge in a Nutshell, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In your career of doing this, Charles, which is one of the most bizarre stories you've come across?
Boy, that's a hard one.
I'm sure there's lots.
There's so many. I think, one might be the similarities between the assassinations of John Kennedy and Abraham Lincoln.
I have heard that when I was younger, too.
You want me to go through that?
Let's go to another one, a little more upbeat.
Okay, let's see. I was going to say all the things that happened on 9/11, but that's...
That's not upbeat.
That's a sad one, yeah. Let's see. Trying to think here as quickly as I can.
Anything with a miracle or anything like that?
Yeah, there's so many miracles. I'm trying to think one with a happy ending. I just thought of one with not a happy ending. Tell that story of a president who gave away his lucky charm and then was assassinated.
No, get me something else.
Okay, you want something happy. Happy. Well,
we're going to start calling you, instead of Dr. Knowledge, Mr. Morbid.
Well, there's just so many, weird things.
Well, let's take some calls while you think about that, okay?
Okay, good, sure.
Let's go to the phones. Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Charles. A couple of questions and a brief baseball thing item. One would be on beverages. Do you have anything on coffee and tea? And then on futurisms from the World's Fairs, including 64, were any of these predictions accurate, or did they fall short? And then on baseball, looking at the history of baseball, this pitcher Mickey Rolich for the Detroit Tigers was not ambidextrous. He was strictly righty, yet pitched lefty.
He was a left-handed pitcher, you're right.
And he hurt his shoulder falling off a motorcycle and was able to pitch lefty. I find that incredible.
Yeah, and there was a pitcher, by the way, who there was a switch pitcher in one game. This was a play for the Montreal Expos. You know, we hear all the time about switch hitters, but there was a switch pitcher. I'm trying to think of his name. We have it in the book. I can't come up with his name right now. But he bothered – he was in the majors for about 10, 15 years. He always bothered his manager. Let me pitch both ways in a game, and nobody would let him do it. Until finally, the last game of a season, he was with the Expos, and it was an unimportant game. Both teams were out of the race. It didn't matter who won. So his manager, who happened to be Felipe Alou, gave him permission to pitch to switch pitch. And he did in one inning against the Cincinnati Reds, as I recall. And the amazing thing is, in other words, he pitched left-handed to left-hand batters and right-handed to right-hand batters, depending on who was up. And switching his pitching arms, he did very well. He walked one person, but he got three outs. And the thing we say in our book...
Is this a guy who recently pitched?
This was in the 1990s.
Because there's another one out there now named Patrick Vindite Jr.
Oh, and he's a switch pitcher.
He's a switch pitcher, yeah.
Yeah, and to sum up the whole thing, the funny part of the story is, what would happen if a switch hitter comes up?
And switched around.
And he kept switching around, and the pitcher kept switching around. That could go on for 2 hours.
Well, I think the batter is stuck once he makes his move.
You are correct.
The pitcher can change anytime he wants.
That's right. Yeah.
That's interesting. Now, you wanted to know about coffee and tea. I don't know. Joe, what was that?
Yeah, just the history of beverages. I know Coca-Cola supposedly had cocaine in it. Just why people choose beverages. And
the story on the naming of Coca-Cola is very interesting, and we have that story in the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. It's the most famous trademark in the world, right?
It sure is.
It was created not by an advertising agency or by any professional. The story is that in the late 1800s, many drugstores had soda fountains, and many of the drugstores created their own fountain drinks. And there was a guy in Atlanta who created a new drink for his drugstore. People seemed to like it, but he didn't know what to call the drink. And his accountant was in the store one day working on the books, and the owner of the drugstore said, people seem to like this drink I have. I don't know what to call it. And the accountant, with absolutely no advertising or marketing experience, came up with a very simple question. He said, well, what are the ingredients? And the guy said, well, I use cola nuts, that was spelled K-O-L-A, and coca leaves. And so the accountant, just while he's working on the books, not even looking up, said, well, why not call it Coca-Cola?
Genius.
Coca leaves and the cola nuts. And so he wrote it out, and instead of spelling cola, as it should be spelled K-O-L-A, but he, to make both words start with the same letter, C, he changed the K in cola to C. And in his distinctive handwriting, which was not uncommon in those days, in the late 1800s, they had, you know, real fancy writing. People wrote very fancily. And this accountant, in his distinctive handwriting, wrote out coca dash cola and underlined it. And that is exactly the way the trademark is today. He created not only the name, but also the signature, the way it is shown, the way it is written today. The most famous trademark in the world. And today, you know, companies spend millions of dollars to come up with a good name.
Yeah, and this guy just did it on a whim.
Not even paying much attention and working on his books, came up with the most famous trademark of all, Coca-Cola. His name was Frank Robinson, by the way. No relation to the great baseball player of the same name.
And they came up with an international program, too, that was huge when they did that television commercial of all those people singing song.
Exactly. That became a hit.
It's the real thing, right?
Yeah. One other thing about the World's Fair that your listener mentioned there, I'm not sure about the other World's Fairs, but the 1939 World's Fair really predicted a lot of things that happened. And I've seen pictures like super highways, as they were called then. This was before we had the interstate highway system. And we didn't have many four-lane divided highways back in those days. It was the 1939 World's Fair. They also had a lot of things on television. That was the first event to be televised. Television was just coming into being. So there were a lot of predictions in that World's Fair that really did come true.
Charles, in the 1900s, during the St. Louis World's Fair, they had pygmies here, and they would sneak out at night, capture dogs from neighbors, and eat them. Now, that's what I heard. I don't know if that's a snub story or what.
At that 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, the ice cream cone was invented there. The guy was selling ice cream, ran out of paper cups, and there was a guy in the next booth who had the cones, and he said, "Can I borrow those?" And he created iced tea was created at the 1904.
That's amazing.
St. Louis.
Well, toasted ravioli was invented in St. Louis. Lady dropped some ravioli into a vat of cooking oil, and hence people liked it.
There was a great movie about the St. Louis World's Fair, Judy Garland.
Yep.
Meet Me in St. Louis.
Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis.
Right. And not only the World's Fair was going on, and the Olympics were going on all at the same time. It was a big summer in St. Louis.
Let's go to Chris in Coastal Bend, Texas. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Merry Christmas to all. And my question for Charles is, are you aware that Dickens wrote a sequel to Christmas Carol?
No, it sounds good.
What was the sequel?
The Chimes. And I just stumbled across it serendipitously this last 2 months, and it's well worth a read. It's called The Goblin Story.
Is Scrooge in that too?
No, it's not the characters per se, but it's a New Year's tale, and it is like Dickens on acid. It is just amazing.
God, why is it so kept quiet, Chris?
Well, it's got some dry bits in it, and I don't know.
You would think that would be a movie or something. Got to look into that. I didn't know that, Charles. Did you?
No. I just seen the movie, by the way, Christmas Carol, the other day, interestingly.
I got to do a wiki on that and Dickens and see if it pops up.
Yeah.
A couple minutes to go with a few more calls. Let's go to Erie County, Pennsylvania. It's Bruce on Coast to Coast. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, sir.
Hey, I'll be fast because it's near the end of the show, but Dr. Knowledge mentioned the mystery of the Easter Island statues.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you had are familiar with the book Aku Aku, by Thor Heyerdahl, which he has photographs and explains it all.
I've heard of that. I haven't read the book. How about you, Charles?
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it yet.
What is his theory, Bruce?
Well, he went to the island, and he had the natives demonstrate the whole thing. And there's photos of them carving the statues, and there's photos of them standing the statues up, but I couldn't find a photo of them pulling the things, and that's what you had mentioned. But there is they explain it in the text. And what they did for a 12-ton statue, they got 180 of the natives to pull on a rope.
Well, they say they weigh 60 to 70 tons, though.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. And some of the talk was that they would walk them into place by trying to shift them side by side like that.
Right.
Like somebody would sway when they walk.
He also had... You know, while we're on that subject, the pyramids presented some of the same problems. You know, how did they get all that, all those stones into place in the pyramids, you know, without, they obviously didn't have lifts and trucks and things like that in those days.
Mary in Burlington County, New Jersey, let's squeeze you in real fast, Mayor. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Merry Christmas. When I was little, I was looking for all the H's in the English translation of the Bible. And I come across YHWH, and you follow a path, and you have, like, did you notice it? Like, Noah, Ham, Shem, Japheth all have an H, and Abram, Sarah are given an H. Anyway, skip up to the month of March. You follow the path. It's longer than that. But the month of March is the only month with an H in it. And when you see the spelling, M-A-R, that's the first three letters of Mary, and C-H are the first two letters of Christ.
Christ, yeah.
It's like Mary, Christ combined for the month of March.
That's
and I Googled March, and they said in the olden days, like the Romans, they considered Mars, the planet Mars, had some connection with the month of March. I can't remember what it is offhand.
So it would be a good month for New Year's, right?
Probably would be. Probably would be. But I kind of like January 1st now, don't you?
Okay. Well, yeah, and it gives you a week with Christmas to have a real, you know, week-long...
Kind of stuck on it.
...holiday, yeah.
Charles, mention your books in your website.
Okay. The name of the book is The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. Our website is knowledgeinanutshell.com. That's one word, knowledgeinanutshell.com. You can see the book there. There's a discount if you want to get more than one for gifts. But the name of the book is The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. It's also on Amazon, and we have an 800 number, 1-800-NUTSHELL. But we recommend you go to our website, knowledgeinanutshell.com, because you can see the book there and read all about it. And, it's good for all ages.
So. Promise to come back?
I'd love to, George.
We love you. Have a great Christmas.
Well, and you're wonderful, and your knowledge is just great. It's so great to be with you.
Knowledge in a Nutshell. We got it from you, Charles. Thanks again for being on the program. Have a great holiday for you and your family. And again, folks, we will be live tomorrow night and on Christmas night and on Thursday and on Friday. Always live shows for you, but we've got some special things on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day night for you that I think you're going to enjoy. And we're going to be tracking Santa tomorrow night throughout the show. He's all over the place. For Dan Galante, Miranda Marino, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasore, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.